This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given.
Olympic victory ceremony, 200 meters, men.
They came out of the chute to walk out to the victory stand. I could see them.
On October 16, 1968, Wyomi Atias and about 200 other athletes crammed into the stands at the Olympic Stadium in Mexico City to watch Americans Tommy Smith and John Carlos accept their medals.
And as they start walking, I'm looking down. I'm like, oh, they don't have their shoes on. What are they doing?
Everyone was expecting something. Smith and Carlos had been heavily involved with a group calling for a black boycott of the Games to protest racial inequality. But they decided to make their stand in a different way.
And they put up their fists and it was like, my. The stadium got so quiet. I mean, just absolute silence. And then the next thing, you could start hearing people mumbling, talking. Then you start to hear voices get louder, whistling, and you hear boos and the cheers. And I kept thinking, I'm really afraid for them. And then I kept thinking, I'm afraid for my life here.
50 years later, everyone knows the story of Tommy Smith and John Carlos. But Wyomi Atias made a stand at those Olympics, too, and far fewer people know her story. Wyomi Atias grew up in the Jim Crow era in a small town called Griffin, Georgia. Her father was a tenant farmer, all of her neighbors were white, and everyone got along pretty well. Wyomi called it her safe haven. She remembers this one time when a new family moved into the neighborhood. One of the boys called Wyomi and her brothers the N-word, but the Atias kids knew how to deal with that.
We would draw a line in the sand or in the dirt and say, okay, if you step across and call us names, that's a problem right there.
The boy stepped across the line and used that word again.
And my brother said, well, you know what? I'm going to let my sister take care of it. I took care of him and kind of beat him up a little bit. And from that day on, we really had no problems.
And this is how it would go. Every so often, a new family would move in, Wyomi would fight, and life would go on, safe haven restored. Her father taught her early not to shy away from conflict.
He just wanted us to make sure we were strong people. Anything we wanted to do, we need to believe in it, fight for it. Always told us, hey, look, it's not always going to be this way. Things are going to change, and I may not see it in my lifetime, but you will.
Things did change, but not in the way Wyomia's father had hoped. One night, when Wyomi was 14, she was at church with her family. Four white men walked in.
It's like, what in the world? What could they want? And they were looking for my dad in a church.
The men were Wyomi's neighbors. They'd come to tell her family that their house was on fire. And just like that, Wyomi lost her safe haven. Her father fell into a deep depression. He never recovered.
Right after that, my father passed away, and that was really devastating to me. I mean, my dad was my rock, and I just, you know, I became a very quiet person, not really talking very much.
Yeah, I have a hard time picturing that.
Well, you know, it's kind of like people ask me these days, do you still run? And I say, I run my mouth now. So.
Wyomi was 15 and still in what she likes to call her quiet phase when she met Ed Temple, the women's track coach at Tennessee State. He invited her to come to Nashville for the summer to train with other high school runners. The camp was free, but Wyomi couldn't afford to get there. Her high school took up a collection and gave her an envelope filled with $23.
And when I get to the train station, not the airport, when I get off in Nashville, Tennessee, Mr. Temple is there, and I was happy about that because I didn't know what I was going to do otherwise. He says, this is Rudolph. I said, okay, hi. I'm like, Rudolph, who is this person?
Later, when she got to the dorms and heard some of the other girls talking, Wyomi figured it out.
Wilma Rudolph starts a saga of individual glory.
She won three gold medals in the Olympics in Rome, and that's who she was, and she was quite famous.
A few years later, Wyomia enrolled at Tennessee State, where Ed Temple was the track coach, and the women on the team were called the Tiger Bells.
When I met the Tiger Bells, they were women that were doing things in life. These women had gone to Europe, they had gone to England, they had gone to Germany, they had gone to Russia. I'd never heard of such.
Over more than four decades coaching the Tiger Bells, Mr. Temple sent 40 women to the Olympics. His athletes won 23 medals. And that's just what Wyomia Tyus wanted to do.
In 1964, I was 19.
Mr. Temple took Wyomia and the Tiger Bells to the Olympic trials. The top three sprinters would go to Tokyo. Wyomia came in third.
And he was like, don't worry about it. We're not looking for great things for you. We just think 68 gonna be your year.
But once she got to Tokyo, Wyomia started thinking she might have a shot in 64 after all. She won her first heat. In her second, she set a new Olympic record. She entered the finals undefeated.
Wyomia Tyus of the U.S. set an Olympic mark in the semifinals.
I said in my head, I could win a gold medal. And then I started thinking, why am I thinking like this? I'm going to get the big head. I don't want that.
She runs her rivals into the ground to reach the tape in 11 and 4/10 seconds.
Edith McGuire, who's my best friend, after the race, she runs up to me, Tyus, you won. I said, I did? She said, yeah. I said, what did you get? And she said, I got second.
Yes, the American Eagle flies high in Tokyo.
Wyomia says she and Edith were treated with respect by the Japanese. But when they returned home, they were reminded of the way things were. Blacks had to sit in the back of the bus, drink from a different water fountain. They didn't have equal opportunities, and they didn't receive a hero's welcome after winning gold and silver at the Olympics.
Edith and I are both from Georgia. She's from Atlanta, Georgia. They only gave us the parade in the black neighborhood. They didn't give us a parade throughout Atlanta. You're talking about the 60s, and that was not much they were doing for people of color.
Wyomia and Edith weren't the only black athletes who noticed they'd been treated better abroad than at home. As the 1968 games approached, Wyomia started hearing about calls for black athletes to boycott the Olympics in Mexico City.
I say I heard about it. It's not like a call and we talked about it on the phone. We were just not contacted as women. They just felt like, they'll go along with whatever we say.
Wyomia doesn't fault anyone for not asking for her opinion on the boycott, but she does wonder why they assumed she'd go along. How can you speak for a group of people, she asks. Eventually, most athletes decided they had more to lose by staying at home than they did by competing in Mexico City. So they went, and it was there that the organizers of the movement, now called the Olympic Project for Human Rights, finally held a meeting and invited everyone, including the women.
We were trying to talk about what could we do as a group. And nobody could come up with one thing. So we just left it as, whatever you would like to do will be okay. And then when Tommy and Carlos did what they did on the victory stand, it was so powerful. It was nothing for anybody else to do.
Tommy Smith and John Carlos, the Olympic 200 meters gold and bronze medalists, had been suspended by the United States Olympic Committee and given 48 hours to leave Mexico.
By the time Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their fists, Wyomia Tyus had already made Olympic history by becoming the first person to repeat as 100-meter champion. In the final, instead of wearing her uniform shorts, white with red and blue trim, she'd worn black shorts in support of the Olympic Project for Human Rights. No one had noticed her quiet protest. But Wyomia had one more race to run, the 4x100-meter relay.
After the relay, we went into the press room, and reporters were just all over us about what Tommy and Carlos had done, and what do you think about this?
In 1968, Wyomia was just starting to come out of her quiet phase. She still hadn't said more than a word or two at a time to reporters.
Well, they asked me a question, yes, no, I don't know, maybe so.
But this time, when reporters asked what she thought, Wyomia had something to say. What is there to think, she said. They made a statement. We all know that we're fighting for human rights. That's what they stood for on the victory stand. Human rights for everyone, everywhere. And to support that and to support them, I'm dedicating my medal to them. I believe in what they did.
I found my voice. You know, there's certain things in life that makes you change. And for me, it makes me become a better person, made me become the person I am.
But while Wyomia had changed, life back home still had not. Nobody was interested in putting a black woman on a pedestal, not even the first ever back-to-back gold medalist in the 100 meters.
Mr. Temple had prepared us, and he would always tell us all the time, you know, you could go to the Olympic Games, you could win 10 gold medals, but you come back here, they don't really care. They give you a parade and a key that doesn't work.
Wyomia kept fighting. She moved to California, helped establish the Women's Sports Foundation, and continued to champion for equal rights. And while she says she sometimes looks around and wonders if she's back in 1968, she has one lasting reminder that not everything is the same as it was 50 years ago. In 1999, Wyomia was asked to come back to her hometown of Griffin, Georgia, for the opening of the Wyomia Tyus Olympic Park. She thought they'd put it in the black neighborhood. She thought it would be small. But when she arrived, she discovered that her park was huge, 168 acres with soccer fields and baseball fields, hiking trails, and a pond you can fish in. The town even put together a torch ceremony, with Wyomia running the last lap.
One of the officials in Griffin came up to me and he just said, Wyomie, we hope this makes up for the things what we didn't do.
Did it make up for what they didn't do before?
I didn't look at it as a makeup. I looked at it more that the people in the town has grown. It takes time. I know we would like to see things move a lot quicker. I just keep thinking about my dad saying, you know, it's not always going to be this way. People are going to change. Here it is 50 years later and a lot more people are aware of what's going on. A lot more people are standing up and speaking out. In order for this to be a better world to live in, that's what we have to do.
Mr. Temple died 2 years ago. That's when Wyomia Tyus decided to write a book to tell people about the good work he'd done. It's called Tiger Bell, the Wyomia Tyus story. This week on the program, in honor of the 50th anniversary of the stand made by Smith and Carlos, we're going to stick with the theme of athletes in protest. From the Polish pole vaulter who withstood the wrath of the Soviets.
I was probably the only person in the world ever who was being booed at while trying to break a world record.
To an Austrian soccer player who may or may not have stood up to the Nazis. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
This message comes from Only a Game sponsor, Samuel Adams. Of all the beers Sam Adams has ever brewed, Boston Lager is their all-time favorite. With its distinctive balance of spicy hops, sweet roasted malts, and smooth finish, it stood the test of time and helped launch the whole craft beer revolution. Sam Adams Boston Lager, full-flavored, rich, and complex. There's nothing quite like the taste of an original. Boston Beer Company, Boston, Mass. Savor responsibly.
More than 20 years. That's how long Olympic gymnastics doctor Larry Nassar abused the girls and women who came to see him for treatment. Believed, a new podcast from Michigan Radio and NPR, digs into how he got away with it for so long.
I'm Karen Given. We've devoted this week's show to looking at what happens when sports and politics collide in protest. Our next story comes from the former Soviet bloc. And in typical Eastern Europe behind the Iron Curtain fashion, it was a blink and you'll miss it kind of activism. Spoiler alert, the Soviets did not blink. From the podcast Stories from the Eastern West, here are Nitzan Reisner and Adam Zhuwovsky.
Let's turn back the clock and go back to Moscow, 1980.
A little bit of background first. This story is about Poland, and Poland was never a part of the Soviet Union per se, but was well within the area of Soviet influence and control. At the beginning of the 1980s, Poland's economy was in decline. The country couldn't pay its foreign debts, and its relationship with the USSR was strained, and would only get worse.
Meanwhile, the 1980 Summer Olympics were to take place in Moscow, but more than 50 countries had boycotted the Games, including the US, Canada, China, and Japan.
what was supposed to be a showcase for the Soviet bloc turned into a somber, grotesque spectacle. Athletes who had taken part in the previous summer games in Montreal couldn't help but compare them.
Montreal was such a beautiful event, but here I couldn't believe the Olympics could be such a nightmare.
That was Władysław Kozakiewicz, the legendary Polish pole vaulter who dominated the event between 1974 and 1982.
We arrived at the village. I looked around and, well, it was surrounded by barbed wire. It wasn't like that in Montreal, but I thought, times change, terrorism and things like that. Security standards were much higher all over the world.
Kozakiewicz says an armed soldier even stopped him from visiting a friend who was staying in the building next door.
W wiosce olimpijskiej mieszkają sportowcy. Co mają tam żołnierze?
The Olympic Village is for athletes. What were soldiers doing there? Who were they defending us from? Seeing how the village was guarded like an airport and they kept checking everybody all the time.
So, the overall atmosphere of the Moscow Olympics was pretty stressful.
And for Kozakiewicz, there was a lot at stake. He'd broken his foot at the Montreal Games and failed to medal. Even though he'd won many major events over the previous 4 years, the fans at home were eager for him to bring back some Olympic hardware.
But the Soviets weren't going to make it easy.
I was incredibly stressed out. We knew that they were obviously cheating, that they were doing everything to make sure the Russians won.
Kozakiewicz saw a Soviet long jumper awarded a fourth attempt, even though he'd fouled three times and should have been eliminated. And he says in shot put and the discus, the judges were cheating too, rounding up the measurements just for the Soviet athletes.
By the morning of the final, Kozakiewicz was a mess.
I was so stressed I could barely talk. I hadn't slept, so in the morning I was like, okay, I'm done with this. Sleepless nights are too much. But that feeling only lasted until I entered the stadium. The moment I saw the packed crowds, it all just left. I was home. Finally, this was my place. The runway, the poles, the bar. Oh yeah, I wasn't even interested in how others were jumping. I had my plan. I didn't even take a warm-up jump. I put my poles away and just waited to see what would happen.
When a pole vaulter is preparing for an attempt, the crowd is often silent. Sometimes, the athlete will encourage them to start clapping in rhythm. Luzhniki Stadium in Moscow was nothing like this.
Throughout the competition, the Russian fans in the stadium were whistling at us and jeering. They booed every non-Soviet athlete and cheered only when a Soviet was up. They did everything they could to get under our skin.
And, as they'd done before, the Soviet authorities made sure the audience was made up of the right sort of people.
Imagine, easily 70,000 people. The stadium really was packed to the very last place, but in part it was because they were shipping people into the stadium, like from jail, prisons. Like there was a whole section full of prisoners from some Moscow penitentiary. But I was so tough back then, all I wanted was to confront the Russians.
But despite the deafening boos and jeers, Kozakiewicz jumped into the lead.
I cleared 5.65 on my first attempt.
That's more than 18.5 feet.
One
by one, my rivals started getting knocked out. The best four only cleared 5.65 on their third attempt. Seeing as I cleared it on my first, I'm leading the competition and feeling pretty confident.
Kozakiewicz had the lead, but his rival, Konstantin Volkov, had the support of the Moscow crowd.
My anger was mounting as the competition went on.
With only four pole vaulters remaining in the competition, Kozakiewicz took his turn and cleared the bar at 5.70 on his first attempt.
Jest! Coś nieprawdopodobnego! Takiej formy nie widzieliśmy chyba Kozakiewicza.
As soon as I cleared that bar at 5.70, that was a gold medal.
Volkov had almost no chance to match that mark. Kozakiewicz knew it, and as he stood up from the landing mattress, he did something completely unexpected.
Pokazałem tego polskiego wała takiego.
I told them, I showed them the arm. You know what I mean. Put it in their Soviet face. Showed my anger for all their whistling.
The obscene gesture Kozakiewicz performed is sometimes called the Italian salute, the bras d'honneur, the Iberian slap,
or simply the arm.
These Olympic Games were supposed to represent friendship, a partnership among the communist nations. And Poland? Poland was supposed to be this quiet little nation that ought to be grateful to the USSR for being allowed to be part of the glorious Soviet bloc.
And this guy stood up in the USSR's capital and showed a, let's call it a regional middle finger to 50,000 of its citizens. It didn't look good.
Luckily for him, this was the 1980s. There were no jumbotrons in Luzhniki Stadium. Much of the crowd didn't even see Kozakiewicz's gesture.
The competition went on. Kozakiewicz's rivals failed to clear the 570 bar. From then on, there was only him and the world record. He asked for the bar to be set at 578 meters, just shy of 19 feet.
My first failed attempt was accompanied by huge cheers and boos from the crowd. Then I took the second jump, again with them all whistling, trying to put me off. And well, I broke the world record. When I landed on the mattress, I stood up and just didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do because I already done everything possible.
So, after lying on the landing mattress for several seconds, Kozakiewicz stood up and...
did it again.
Nobody in the stadium seemed to notice. The event was over and Kozakiewicz returned to his apartment in the barbed-wired Olympic Village.
Później zaczęło mnie świtać w głowie, że...
Later, I started realizing that I was probably the only person in the world ever who was being booed at while trying to break a world record.
Did he realize what he'd done, though?
No, that's the thing. I did it because they totally deserved it. It just came completely natural to me.
Kozakiewicz didn't intend to make any sort of political statement. Of course, the political context was there. Poles were often targets of Soviet propaganda for their political disobedience, and almost everybody in Poland was fed up with the whole Soviet bloc-Warsaw Pact situation. But Kozakiewicz, he wasn't thinking about any of that. He simply very emotionally reacted to how the audience had been treating him. Reality, however, soon made him realize what he had done. The very next day, the head of the Polish Olympics team took him aside and said,
"That gesture you did yesterday, they want you disqualified and your medal taken away." I looked at him. I couldn't believe it. Take my medal away? If I would shown everyone my butt or punched somebody, then I would understand. But for this, I must have gotten to them.
The Soviet ambassador in Warsaw officially demanded Kozakiewicz be disqualified for life and his medal rescinded for, quote, offending the whole Soviet nation. A disciplinary commission gathered and voted in favor of Kozakiewicz's disqualification. He would lose the gold medal and his world record.
The case seemed to have been irreversibly lost. But then, Jose Antonio Samaranch, the future chairman of the International Olympic Committee, ran late into that disciplinary committee meeting and intervened.
Somehow they annulled this vote and decided they weren't going to take my medal after all. I heard it was a real knife edge as to whether they were gonna take it or not.
Outside the sporting world, the incident took on a life of its own. Poland was on the brink of a social and political revolution, with its first major strikes coming in the following months. When Poles saw Kozakiewicz's gesture, they loved how it showed defiance. That arm became a symbol for the whole nation rising up against the Soviet Union. When Kozakiewicz came home, people on the streets wouldn't let him pass, chanting his name, shaking his hand, hugging him, cheering him on, tossing him into the air even.
Suddenly, he was a hero, someone who had single-handedly stood up against tyranny, had won even, and had spoken for the whole nation. He became a symbol of resistance, so...
So for Kazakiewicz, the real trouble was only just getting started. The Polish Light Athletics Association, his employer, was still essentially controlled by the Soviet government.
Back in Poland, thanks to that arm, they soon started disqualifying me from different events. They would take my passport away sometimes, make me stay home. They even took my stipend money away. But basically, I was jobless. They still wanted me to train and be in top form, but at the same time, I wasn't allowed to compete and I wasn't getting any money at all. Later on, I was just so sick of it all that I wrote them an official letter saying I was resigning from ever representing Poland at all.
In 1985, Kozakiewicz packed his car and drove to Hanover, West Germany, never to return to the People's Republic of Poland again. He competed as a member of the Hanover Sports Club, and then, in 1986, he became a German citizen and started representing Germany.
West Germany was officially considered a hostile state to communist-ruled Poland, and Kozakiewicz's emigration was regarded as treason. The home he owned in Poland was taken away, and the Polish communist authorities tried to use their leverage to stop him from taking part in competitions all over the world.
His exile ended in 1989, when Poland finally shook off Soviet domination. Kozakiewicz still lives in Germany, but he often visits Poland, where his protest at the 1980 Olympics made him a national hero.
Speaking honestly, this gesture really helped me a lot in life. It even showed me that I should move away. I know what I did gave other people a lot of happiness, showing that. And I'm proud I showed them, let them see that you can resist in your own way. But it wasn't heroic, and I still don't think of myself as a hero.
And the obscene gesture Kozakiewicz performed in that Moscow stadium in 1980...
The Italian salute, the bras d'honneur, the Iberian slap or the arm...
...went on to be nicknamed Kozakiewicz's gesture in Poland. And that's the only term people use for it.
That was Adam Dziwowski and Nitzan Reisner from the podcast Stories from the Eastern West. That piece was written, produced, and scored by Wojciech Oleksiak. Check out their podcast for a bonus story exploring how athletes from the Soviet bloc really got paid, or didn't. We'll have a link at onlyagame.org. Coming up, the story of an athlete who may have lost his life over his act of resistance on the soccer pitch. Maybe.
Certainly a beautiful sentiment, but we realize it just doesn't match what we know.
That's just ahead on Only a Game, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We do long-form interviews with the people behind the best books, pop culture, journalism, and more, so you can get to know the people whose work you love. You'll find Fresh Air on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, we find out what happens when a college lacrosse player gets tired of braiding her teammates' hair and decides to start a voter registration campaign instead. But now I'm here with Charlie Pierce for the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Karen.
On Wednesday, three people were found guilty of wire fraud in the college basketball corruption trial. I was surprised that prosecutors were able to convince a jury that universities were victimized by a plot to bring them better basketball players. You?
Yeah, I was shocked by that too, actually, Karen. I'm dying to see the appeals on this because the whole theory of the case is absurd and has been absurd ever since we first heard about it. But now these guys are facing serious time and some ambitious U.S. attorney is going to get promoted and nothing about the sport itself will change.
Now that the trial is over, the NCAA could decide on the basis of court testimony and the information that prosecutors weren't even allowed to enter into evidence that the three victim schools should be subject to further NCAA sanctions. Does that seem likely to you?
Yeah, I think they'll take every advantage they can out of this because it has deflected all the attention away from the notion that the NCAA was about to fall apart, basically due to common sense. And that's what this trial has been about from day one.
Charlie, as you may know, I was once a WBUR intern. Unpaid intern. Little did I know that if I had just gone up the street, I could have earned $1 million.
Yeah, this is the now new free marketplace if you happen to be a talented 17 or 18-year-old basketball player. Darius Baisley was going to go to Syracuse. He's the number 13 prospect in the country, if you believe ESPN's rankings. He decommitted from Syracuse, which sort of makes him sound like a battleship that's going to be taken apart. And he was going to play in the G League. And then he got a three-month job with New Balance and wound up making $1 million as a quote-unquote New Balance intern.
Baisley's agent says his client will stay in basketball shape by looking for competitive pickup games. Am I the only one who's noticed that the New Balance headquarters is located right next door to the Celtics' new practice facility?
You are absolutely not the only person to notice that. And I'm sure Rich Paul, his agent, has also noticed that.
The L.A. Lakers and LeBron James lost their first three games of the season, which isn't great, but it's better than what's happening with ticket sales in Cleveland, right?
Oh, God. Well, you knew this was coming. Cleveland is, this is a franchise that outside of LeBron James has virtually no history whatsoever. Tickets are going very, very cheaply.
$2.
$2 for, of course, they were playing the Nets, too. So, I mean, I think you might have been able to goose the scalper to $2.50.
In August, ESPN labeled the Maryland football culture as, quote, toxic. This week, after a two-month investigation, an eight-person commission says, quote, the Maryland football team did not have a toxic culture, but it did have a culture where problems festered because too many players feared speaking out. And I'm really confused because when you use a word like festered, I'm really thinking toxic.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of odd, actually. There's a difference, like, if you drink poison, then you've done something toxic, but if you get a wound and you don't, like, take care of it with antiseptic and it festers, I guess technically that's not toxic.
Well, here are some of the things that the commission decided were not toxic. A coach who used homophobic slurs, threw food, weights, and only on one occasion, a trash can filled with vomit at players. And let's not forget 19-year-old defensive lineman Jordan McNair died of heat stroke in May. Where does this story go from here?
I don't know, but I think somebody else ought to investigate the program. Because if this is what was defined as not being toxic, I don't even want to know what actually would be.
And finally, Charlie, we would be remiss if we didn't at least mention the World Series between the Red Sox and the Dodgers. And so I have chosen the most important topic for our discussion. As you know, the nation will be lining up on November 1st for free tacos, but not Red Sox utility player Brock Holt. Please explain.
Mookie Betts stole a base in that insured free tacos at all Taco Bell locations. And Brock Holt tweeted out that he won't be getting a free taco. Quote, I'm going to stay away from the Taco Bell. You end up on the toilet all night. This is not the brand that Taco Bell was seeking. And Brock Holt has since apologized. These are, again, we are collecting a list now of things Connie Mack didn't have to worry about. Insulting fast food chains is right at the top of the list.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated, and he joins us each week here on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Karen.
On April 3, 1938, just 3 weeks after the annexation of Austria, Nazi officials arrived at Vienna's Prater Stadium. They were there to watch a soccer match. It was an exhibition between the national teams from Germany and Austria. The idea was that the two sides would play a friendly game before coming together to form a single team for the 1938 World Cup. Only a Game's Martin Kessler picks up the story.
If you Google the name Matthias Sindelar, you'll find quite the tale.
pretty much the first five hits you'll get talk about his defiance against the Nazis, often stories that come from, again, really reputable sources.
That's author Kevin Simpson. He's read a lot of those articles about Sindelar, one of the Austrian strikers who took the field for that April 3rd match against the Germans.
The game was supposed to be a competitive draw to make everyone happy.
In other words, it was supposed to end in a tie. But in the second half, with the score 0-0, Sindelar scored. A teammate followed with another goal to make it 2-0. And that, the stories go, is when Matthias Sindelar made his way to the center of the pitch and staged his act of defiance.
Danced a jig, essentially, in front of the Nazi elite who were gathered there for this match.
Some accounts even specify that Sindelar had a grin on his face as he danced before the box of Nazi officials. A few months later, Sindelar declared he would not play for the unified German team. Instead, he was retiring from soccer. Less than a year later, he was found dead. The stories will tell you that perhaps the Gestapo killed him, or that maybe he killed himself, unable to go on living in a Vienna ruled by the Nazis. Just days after Sindelar's body was found, Alfred Polgar, an Austrian-born theater critic, wrote,
"The good Sindelar followed the city whose child and pride he was to its death. He was so inextricably entwined with it that he had to die when it did. All the evidence points to suicide prompted by loyalty to his homeland, for to live and play football in the downtrodden, broken, tormented city meant deceiving Vienna with a repulsive specter of itself. But how can one play football like that and live when a life without football is nothing?"
Certainly a beautiful sentiment, but we realize it just doesn't match what we know.
Kevin Simpson doesn't believe that Sindelar was murdered, or that he took his own life. And that's not the only part of the popular Matthias Sindelar story that's been called into question.
If we look closer at the whole story, we have to say most of it wasn't really true.
That's Austrian researcher Georg Spitaler. He believes Matthias Sindelar never was nor intended to be a Nazi protester. So who was he really? And if he wasn't a hero, why has he been held up as one? Could you sort of just take me through what's happening in Austria throughout the 30s?
Chaos, quite frankly, even more so than in Germany.
After World War I, Vienna was governed by the Social Democrats. But in the 1930s, fascism spread.
Even in the years between 1933 and 1938 in Austria, there was also a kind of Austrian fascism before the Nazis took over in 1938.
Still, Kevin Simpson says there were places throughout Vienna that were largely free of fascism.
The coffee house is the gathering place, almost like the salons used to be in Paris during the 20s. The intellectuals would gather there. The artists would as well, and they would have been very much aligned against the Nazi movement.
And politics wasn't the only topic of conversation.
You'd have this wonderful interplay of culture and ideas, and it didn't take them long to bring football into that discussion.
The Austrian team was one of the best teams in Central Europe and on the continent.
And Matthias Sindelar was the team's star.
He was quite thin and small, and that's how he got his nickname. In German, it's der Papierene. So I don't know how to translate that. Like, he was made out of paper.
He was seen as kind of a paper man, was the more casual translation.
Matthias Sindelar, a.k.a. the paper man, didn't come from an elite intellectual family. They immigrated to Vienna from Moravia. Sindelar grew up poor. His father labored in the brickworks. But Kevin Simpson says the people who gathered in Vienna's coffee houses admired the way the paper man used his creativity to get the best of bigger and stronger opponents.
Sindelar was routinely the one talked about.
Both Spitaler and Simpson believe Sindelar was a social democrat, or at least sympathized with the party. But Spitaler says the soccer star didn't speak publicly about his beliefs. And the real questions begin to crop up in March 1938 with the Anschluss, when Nazi tanks crossed into Austria.
The Austrian Nazis were lying in wait for this very event. So when it happens, the zeal with which they embrace Hitler and his associates even shocks those in Berlin.
So in general, the Austrians were pretty sympathetic.
Very much so. And it didn't take long for the banners and the swastikas and propaganda machinery to kick into effect.
Part of that propaganda machinery was the April 3rd reunification match in Vienna between the Austrian and German teams. Sindelar netted the go-ahead goal, but as for that celebratory jig, Simpson says it happened.
I believe that Sindelar danced in front of the Nazi elite. There is enough corroborating evidence from contemporaries and those who were maybe next generation. I believe that to be true.
But Georg Spitala isn't so sure. He says that based on old newsreel footage of the game, Sindelar didn't seem to be acting out of the ordinary.
It doesn't look different than any other celebration at the time, I think.
There's also a question about whether politics was the real reason Sindelar chose to retire rather than join the German team.
I mean, on one hand, he was quite old for a football player at the time, so he was, I think, in his early 30s.
He was 35.
So we could suspect it had also, like, reasons that had more to do with, like, his physical condition and less with political reasons.
And Spitala says that if the Nazis were upset about any of Sindelar's actions, they didn't seem to show it. He says the Nazis helped Sindelar acquire a cafe that they'd taken from a Jewish man as part of Aryanization.
If it was an act of resistance, the Germans didn't really care and tried to help afterwards with jobs.
As for the soccer star's unexpected death, neither Simpson nor Spitala find it likely that Sindelar killed himself or was murdered. They believe the official report that he died from a gas leak.
A faulty heater was most likely the cause.
Back in these days, that was quite a common thing to happen.
Kevin Simpson still considers Sindelar a heroic figure for his decision to retire rather than represent Germany. And Spitaler agrees that the soccer star at least behaved better than many Austrians. But how did we get this tale that Sindelar was a Nazi resistor who died for his beliefs? Simpson and Spitaler first point to some of the coffeehouse intellectuals, the writers and artists who admired Sindelar and opposed fascism.
For to live and play football in the downtrodden, broken, tormented city meant deceiving Vienna with a repulsive specter of itself.
And there was also Friedrich Thorberg, another anti-Nazi Austrian writer who was in exile at the time of Sindelar's death. He wrote a poem called Death of a Footballer,
where he kind of builds on this myth that Sindelar was a victim, that he was a symbol of old Austria, kind of being killed by the new Nazi rulers.
And that myth may have carried on after the war thanks to another myth out of Austria, that Austria was Hitler's first victim.
That was fed for decades after the war. Some of it has to do with the unwillingness to acknowledge their contribution to the Holocaust. Austria's hands were dirty, and it makes sense that they'd want to push this history to the side by embracing this myth.
Spitaler says the story of Matthias Sindelar, a soccer star who defied the Nazis, fits into that narrative quite nicely.
And his person was used by very different political groups, authors, journalists, especially after 1945, to build on this myth of Austrian victimhood. And he was a perfect symbol for that.
Are people really bummed, though, when you tell them the more complex story about this guy who's been held up as such a hero?
Yeah, sometimes they're disappointed, and I'm really sorry for that. But, I mean, still, for me as a political scientist, it's more a proof to the case that sports was so important for politics and still is. So I think it's a really interesting story with all the complexities, and this makes it a good story.
And it's a story that's endured. Georg Spitala remembers turning on Austrian national television as a kid in the 70s or early 80s, decades after Sindelar's death. And there on the screen was a well-known actor reading a poem. It was Friedrich Thorberg's Death of a Footballer.
That's Only a Game's Martin Kessler. Kevin Simpson is the author of Soccer Under the Swastika. We We started this show with Tommy Smith and John Carlos raising their black-gloved fists on the victory stand. And we're going to end there, too. Here's commentator Kenneth Shropshire.
I was 13 years old and watching on a black-and-white Magnavox in our Los Angeles basement. As a 10-year-old, I had seen the Watts riots close up and have an everlasting memory of National Guard troops staging in the Crenshaw Shopping Center while my mother rushed me past a machine gun-mounted Jeep to buy groceries at Vaughn's Market.
15 citizens injured, 19 officers hurt.
My entire life had been lived in the background of the national fight for civil rights and major global events. Bus boycotts, marches in Washington, the space race, and the Cuban Missile Crisis. This was a black baby boomer coming-of-age chronology. That summer, James Brown released Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. Among all of the other changes of puberty, I was no longer Negro, but black, and swept up in a full-blown black power movement. The prism for me of the 1968 Olympic protest was a moment of pride and empowerment. Much like many today in regards to NFL players kneeling to protest social justice issues, the anti-patriotism angle is not what I saw. Don't get me wrong, I understand the analysis. I better see it as a conundrum. If you don't protest in a way that causes discomfort, you won't get the attention needed to highlight your issue. Without a doubt, there was no moment bigger than the Olympics in terms of attention. After all, these were the first games that were broadcast in color. Also, the patriotic aura of the Olympics of 1968 was today's environment on steroids. Looking back, there was no bigger, connected moment to protest the issues concerning the Olympic Project for Human Rights. Looking back, the only bigger moment could have been on the victory stand for the men's 100 meters, the race that crowns the world's fastest human. But the 200 was more than adequate. On Thursday, October 17th, 1968, we were back at Audubon Junior High School. Everybody in gym class wanted to be John Carlos or Tommy Smith. They were bad men. In our community, we knew what they were saying and that they were speaking for all of us. 50 years ago, it was black power versus patriotism, a framing that conflicts many of us today with the social justice protest of the National Football League. I believe in social justice, but that flag thing.
If people say your dreams are crazy.
The irony today is the best known athlete activist of the moment, Colin Kaepernick, now has a Nike advertising campaign. John Carlos, Tommy Smith, and even Peter Norman, the white guy on the victory stand, spent years trying to get their lives back on track after that protest. None of them ever had a major apparel deal accompanying their activism.
Believe in something, even if it means sacrificing everything.
Like the long road of societal acceptance rehab that brought anti-war protester Muhammad Ali to the forefront of athlete heroes, the road Smith and Carlos have taken took a turn upward as well. Overall, 50 years later, this is a time of celebration, where the purpose of the protest is much more clearly grasped by all. More of us can see it now, but I still see it through the eyes of a 13-year-old praying for an equal chance and respect in the world ahead.
That was commentator Kenneth Shropshire. He's the CEO of the Global Sport Institute and professor of global sport at Arizona State University. A longer version of this essay was written for globalsportsmatters.com. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.